This is the first day of the 53rd New Zealand Christadelphian Bible School. Our second period speaker, our first period speaker, is Brother David Pearce on The Land Flowing with Milk and Honey. The subtitle for today is The Promised Land. This is the first talk in his series. And the introductory reading was Deuteronomy chapter 11, verses 8 to 21. Brother David.
There we are. Land flowing with milk and honey. So this first talk really is an introductory one. A little bit about the geography of the land of Israel that they came to and the difference it was going to be from Egypt where they had spent such a long time. So that's our title. And we want to point out right at the beginning that the Israelites had actually been in the land of Egypt for over 200 years. And you can calculate that by some fairly simple arithmetic, even though it is 7:30 in the evening or something. You have this figure in Galatians chapter 3, verse 17. You might want to just quickly turn to this with me, please. Galatians 3, verse 17. We have an important statement here by the apostle that gives us a sort of landmark in time. So, Galatians chapter 3, this is the one about the work of Jesus as the Redeemer. And in verse 17, he says, the covenant that was confirmed of God in Christ, the law, which was 430 years after, cannot disannul. Now, the covenant is the covenant he made with Abraham. The promise that he made to Abraham, Genesis chapter 15, that he would give him the land which he was walking in and to his descendants after him forever. And from that point, says the apostle, till the giving of the law, which was in the first few months after they left Egypt in the Exodus, was 430 years. Now, if we do a little bit more calculating here, from the time God made that promise to Abraham until the birth of Isaac, you can work out it was about 25 years. And then Isaac was amazingly 60 years old when he had his first children, twins, Jacob and Esau. And then Jacob himself, when he went down into Egypt, was 130 years old when he appeared before Pharaoh. So, if we add those figures together like this, take the 430, knock off 25, knock off 60, knock off 130, you come to something like over 200 years in the land of Egypt as slaves. And that means that the Israelites who lived in Egypt had no memories whatever of Canaan. They knew nothing of the land from which their ancestors came, except perhaps what grandma, great-grandma had been able to tell them. And even she wouldn't be able to go back far enough to say anything in detail about this wonderful land that Abraham had been promised. And we know that in Egypt, the people of Israel were very seriously oppressed by the Egyptians. Here's a statement from Exodus chapter 1. The Egyptians made the Israelites their slaves. They made their lives bitter, forcing them to mix mortar and make bricks and do all the work in the fields. And they were ruthless in their demand. That's the ESV version, which I shall probably be using mostly in these talks. They were ruthless in their demands. Now, what did that involve? Well, if you go to the British Museum, you can see all sorts of little tiny models from Egypt of slaves working for their masters. Now, you understand when a rich Egyptian died, he assumed that his spirit, his ka, would go away somewhere, but from time to time would want to come back into his body, and that's why his body had to be embalmed, so it was still there. But when the ka came back into his body, it would, of course, still want its servants to prepare his dinner, to polish his shoes, to catch his fish, to plough his fields. And, of course, all those servants themselves would be long dead. In the very early times, the time of Abraham, the unfortunate servants were killed with the king and buried with him, literally in the same grave. But by the time of the Egyptians, they made models instead, and that was to do. So here's some people, a young lady there, for example. She's grinding corn. We shall come back to this later on in our talk, of course. First thing you do in the morning is to grind the corn. All over Egypt, you'd hear this rasping noise, as all the ladies were grinding corn. Here's some slaves busy rowing the Pharaoh's boat up and down the River Nile. Here's some more slaves digging the fields, top feet, part there, scattering corn down here, bottom left-hand corner. And that's working in the fields, which we just read. And this, of course, is a much more famous picture where they're making bricks. This is a picture from the Egyptian tombs of slaves making bricks. And you can see the whole process there, from puddling the clay with the feet here, making the moulding the bricks there and moulds, and then taking them off to be to build the treasure cities of Ramesses. And up in the top left-hand corner with his head chopped off in the frieze is the taskmaster with his big whip to keep the slaves working hard. So, yes, they were in distress. And that's what God says to Moses, I have certainly seen the oppression of my people in Egypt. I've heard their cries of distress because of their harsh slave drivers, and I've come down, God comes down, to rescue them from the power of the Egyptians and lead them out of Egypt, here it is, into their own fertile and spacious land. It is, near this phrase comes again, a land flowing with milk and honey. Now, there's something very special about those two expressions, a land flowing with milk and honey. Where did you get milk from? Cows in those days? Goats also? Sheep, yes, they all produce milk. To produce milk, you've got to have grass. And in Egypt, there's very little grass, because there's no rain. But in the land they were going to, there'd be plenty of rain and plenty of grass, and they'd be able to have plenty of milk. And butter and cheese, of course. What about honey? To make honey, you have to have bees. Bees have to have flowers. Very few flowers in Egypt, no trees. There's no water, except for the Nile that flows through. You have to make channels off that, as we shall see, if you want to use the water to grow things. But in the land they were going to, there would be lots of flowers and trees, and there would be lots of honey. So there's a meaning behind those two phrases, milk and honey, plentiful grass and flowers and trees. And that's what it says in the chapter, Deuteronomy chapter 8. Let's have a quick look there again. Deuteronomy 8 and verses 7 to 9. Verses 7 to 9. The Lord thy God bringeth thee into a good land, a land of brooks of water, fountains and depths that spring out of valleys and hills. So different to Egypt, where there's only the Nile and the canals coming off the Nile. A land of wheat and barley and vines and fig trees and pomegranates, a land of olive oil and honey, a land wherein thou shalt eat bread without scarceness, and land where thou shalt not lack anything in it. So what a wonderful land that was going to be, compared with the Egypt that they'd known since their childhood, a land with no rain, perhaps once every 2 years, no forests, no trees, nothing grows without water, and that has to be taken from the Nile. In fact, farming in Egypt, even today, is very labour-intensive compared with the land they were going to. Here's a picture, a painting actually, of how even today they raise water from the Nile. If they haven't got electric pumps or diesel pumps, this is what they still have to do. You have a counterweight, big stone on the end there, to counterweight the bucket, which drops into the water. You pull it up, and the counterweight makes it easy to pull up. And then you tip that into the churns and take them off to your house or to pour around your plants in the back garden to grow your cabbages. So the other thing you have to do, too, even today, is to take the water from the Nile out to the crop in furrows. This is an aerial photograph. So these channels here are coming off the Nile, and they go down into the field. And in the field itself, you've got these channels which take the water down the crop. And this man here is blocking off with his spade the trough to stop the water going any further. And that's what it means. Well, we should come to this. When the land being full of rain, you won't need to do all that to water your crop. The water will come down from the sky, free, just like that, instead of having to go to all this labour just to produce enough water to grow a crop. So, another great point, of course, was that in Egypt, the people, being slaves, had no freedom. They couldn't decide when to get up and go to bed, or where to go for their holidays, because they didn't have any holidays. They had no freedom, and they had no property. Just a little hut to live in, probably. But that's about it. And now Moses was promising them that each family could have its own little farm. And it must have been like a dream to them. Can you imagine? You've grown up as a slave, your father was a slave, your grandfather was a slave, And now your family is going to have its own little farm. Now, when they came to Mount Sinai, you remember that Moses gave them the law from God. And the law ruled that each family in Israel would have its own little small holding. And the boundaries of that piece of land would be marked permanently with big stones, and nobody was to move those, because that plot of land, marked off by those stones, would stay in the possession of that family in perpetuity. And remember, even if they came on hard times during their stay in that particular plot and had to sell the land to get some money, after every 50 years, they were returned to their inheritance automatically, free of charge. They always had to come back to their own inheritance in the year of Jubilee. So that farm, that piece of land, belonged to the family forever after. Remember how Naboth refused to give over his inheritance to wicked King Ahab. So that meant that every family in Israel would no longer be dependent on the Egyptians for some bread and water. They would have their own means to produce food, of course, drink, as you come to that, the vine, and clothing, of course, too, from the animals, skins and wool to make wool. So this is what the spies reported when they went off to spy the land that they were going to, and they come back to the Israelites and say, yes, the land we entered is indeed a bountiful country, a land, it's the same expression, a land flowing with milk and honey. And they gave an example, as you've got on your catalogue today, or your programme. This is the kind of fruit it produces. And there's this huge single bunch of grapes. It had to be carried by two men, it was so big. Amazing. So that was the land, and this was the proof. They brought it back to the Israelites. This is the land of flowing with milk and honey. And you get the same expression again later in the Law of Moses, where every year, the father of the family had to take his folks to the place where God has set his name, the tabernacle, later the temple, of course. And as he comes to this place, he brings the first fruits, the very first cutting of the harvest, plucking of the fruit from the tree, the first lamb to be born to his sheep. And he comes to God and he says, now, O Lord, Deuteronomy 26, verses 9 and 10, now, O Lord, I have brought you the first portion of the harvest you have given me from the ground. And he says, God gave us this land flowing with milk and honey. So God did keep his word to Moses, and although the spies spoiled it all because of their bad report and it was delayed by 40 years, they did eventually get into this wonderful place that Moses promised them, this land flowing with milk and honey. So let's have a look at this land in the geography now. Sorry about this for going back to school, but it's useful to know this because it introduces the agriculture. The land of Israel, and some of you have been there. Hands up if you've been to Israel. A sprinkling of you have been to Israel. It is indeed a land with a great variety of landscapes. In such a tiny country, you can go a short distance and the whole scenery changes. The strip alongside the Mediterranean, the coastal plain, is fertile, very good soil, and it's very good for growing heavy crops like wheat. So that's where you get your bread from. And then the land, as you go away from the Mediterranean towards the west, you go into the foothills, which are called the Shephelah, and they're ideal for grazing, for cattle, particularly. And then as you get up to the central mountain range that runs right down the spine of the land of Israel, that's where you get the rainfall, because it being high above sea level, you get a lot more humidity, a lot more rainfall, and that's ideal for grazing of sheep and goats. Nimble-footed creatures that can climb rocks and go up into the mountains, whereas the cows prefer the rather shallower foothills for grazing, because with their cloven hoofs, they're not so good at climbing up mountains. And then, of course, on the other side of the mountains, the land drops down into this huge valley, which is tropical. It's so hot down there, it's a tropical landscape. So, here's a diagram. Only 70 kilometres, really, across the useful part of the land, from the coast to the far side of the Jordan Valley. And from north to south, again, from the Galilee, where the mountains start up there, and that's Mount Hermon right at the very top of the picture, so beyond there, it's not really habitable. And down to the Negev at the bottom here, where it's, again, desert, Only 250 kilometres. Some of you have come that distance today in your cars to get it. That's the size of the whole land of Israel that the people were going to. Tiny country. An amazing range of heights as well. The highest point in the mountains, quite close to just north of Jerusalem, is 800 metres above sea level. But the lowest point in the Jordan Valley, minus 365. So if you look at it in cross-section, this is what you sort of see. There's the Mediterranean Sea on the left there. You can see the coastal plain, the Shephela. As you come away from the sea, you climb up into the mountains. There's the mountain range where Jerusalem's right on top. And then you drop down precipitously into the Jordan Valley, way below sea level. And you climb up the other side to what is now Jordan, of course, where Mount Nebo, where Moses died. So the coastal plain is very good for growing wheat. The middle part, the Shephela, is excellent for cattle and sheep. And the mountains are good for sheep and goats, which need the grass and are nimble. Also, of course, timber, the forests up there on the hills. And then on the other side, the Araba, the Jordan Valley, that's where you get palm trees with dates and vegetables. And then on the far side, the very far side, you remember the 10 tribes. Of the 10 tribes, Reuben, Gad, and part of Manasseh, asked to be given that part of the land because that tableau, plateau, good, thank you. That plateau on the other side of the Jordan is excellent, as they said, is excellent for cattle. And we're cattle farmers, they said, cattle ranchers. That's where they settled. So that's the description of this amazing land that God had promised to Abraham 200 years ago, and now they were entering into that country where their forefathers once walked in tents and camped and moved about, waiting for God to fulfill his promise to them. Now, a little bit about the weather in Israel. There is a very definite wet season, which starts in October with what they call the early rains. Now, if you'd like to turn, please, with me to Joel chapter 2, you'll see a mention there of the early rains. Joel chapter 2 and verse 23. Be glad then, ye children of Zion, and rejoice in the Lord your God, for he hath given you, here it comes, the former rain moderately, and he will cause down to come down to you the rain, the former rain, and the latter rain in the first month. So we've got two periods of rain there, a former rain and a latter rain in the first month. Those early rains came in October after the summer. And the summer in Israel lasts for three whole months of no rain. So at the beginning of that period in October, the ground is hard, like concrete. The grass is now withered and brown. There's nothing growing. And you have to have that early rain in October to soften the ground sufficiently to plough and sow your seeds. And without the early rain, nothing can grow. So God is promising here that he will send them the former rain moderately, it says in the Authorized Version, although it says in the margin, it says according to righteousness. So perhaps it means if you are righteous, I'll give you the former rain, the early rain. So that's October. That softens the ground. At that point, you can start to do your ploughing and then sow your seeds. And there's enough moisture there to get the seeds germinating. The wheat comes up out of the ground and it moves on. Now, the winter rain comes between December and February. And for this, we need to go to Ezra chapter 10, a mention of this period of the year when it is very wet in Israel. So Ezra, back a bit in the Bible, Kings, Chronicles, Ezra, and it's chapter 10 this time. And verse 9. Remember, Ezra's come back from Babylon with a little group, a big group actually, of priests, a very little group of Levites, and they come back to Jerusalem, and he's discovered, sadly, that the people there have intermarried with their surrounding neighbours, the Gentiles, and were no longer separate as they should have been. And so he calls together a national assembly. Verse 8, as a penalty, if you don't assemble within 3 days, you forfeit your substance and you'll be separated from the congregation. So everybody had to come to Jerusalem for this national assembly to discuss this awful thing that they intermarried with the Gentiles. And so verse 9, all the men of Judah and Benjamin, because those are the people who had returned, remember, the 10 tribes are still away somewhere in captivity or dispersion now, and they never really come back. Judah and Benjamin are the two tribes that have returned from the captivity in Babylon, the first group in the time of Cyrus, and now a second group later in the time of Ezra. So they've all gathered together to Jerusalem within the 3 days. Nobody wanted to have his property forfeited. And it was the ninth month. It was the ninth month, and the people sat in the street of the city of the house of God, verse 9, finishing, trembling because of this matter and for the great rain. So here we have the great rain in the ninth month of the year. So in Israel, you start the year in March. Passover comes in the first month. 14th day of the first month, Passover. So that's the beginning of the year. And now 9 months later, we come to the winter rain that falls. And actually, in Jerusalem, on the mountains there, it will very often snow in this period between January and February. Really cold. So it's not surprising those people weren't too happy having to sit out in the street at this time of the year. I've been to Jerusalem even in March and forgot to take suitable clothing and really shivered for a whole day. Came back with a cold to England. Yeah. So that leaves finally the latter rains. The latter rains, which we read about in Joel. Let's have a look at Hosea this time. Hosea has the latter rains in his book as well. Hosea chapter 6. And verse 3, this shall we know if we follow on to know the Lord. His going forth is prepared as the morning, and he, God, shall come unto us as the rain, something to look forward to, as the latter and former rain unto the earth. So the latter and the former rain, two different kinds of rain, the former rain in October, the latter rain. The latter rain comes in March, time of the Passover, and it bulks out the crops, which have now been growing to the full height. They're in ear, and actually the barley in March is almost ready for cutting. Wheat will take a couple of months later than that in April. But this is when the latter rain bulks out the heads of those ears and gives a really good crop if it comes. So you needed those two periods of rain, the early rain to wet the ground and get the seeds in, the latter rain to bulk out the crop just before harvest time. Now, as we said, the dry season fits in between those two periods of rain. The dry season really goes properly from May right through to October, and it is completely dry. There is no rain in Israel much between those two dates. The nights are quite cold, and as a result, you get dew. Quite heavy dew in Israel, particularly on the mountains, at this time of the year between May and October. And that's a very important factor in growing crops, because the weight of water that comes down in the dew is significant. You remember the story of Gideon? He sets out a sheep's fleece, the size of this table, and in the morning it's so full of dew he can wring it out into a bucket. I imagine all that water falling everywhere in the dew. It's quite a factor in watering the crops in this dry period when there's no actual rain from heaven to make the crops grow. So here's a kind of, you probably can't all see this now, but splitting up the year into months. On the left-hand side, we've got the first, second, third, fourth, down to the 12th month. There's the names for them in Hebrew, which we didn't bother with. The equivalent names in our calendar, first month is in March, the Passover. And that's when you get the latter rains for the barley harvest. The April, May is the time when you sheep or shear your sheep. Get that right again. When you shear your sheep, May and June, you do the wheat harvest. It follows nearly 2 months later than the barley, which is right at the top there. In the fourth month, June and July, you go through the vineyards and you trim the vines. We shall come to that when we talk about wine production in Israel. And then, as we come into the autumn, that's when you start picking your crops. The grapes, the figs, the olives all become ripe in August, September. And that's the time when you take your first fruits and up to Jerusalem. That's the time for the Feast of Tabernacles, when you rejoice before the Lord with all your household, your servants, taking with you the produce that you've grown, and you eat it there before the Lord, giving thanks to him. So the clock begins to spin round now in October, September. The early rains allow the ploughing for sowing the next crop of wheat. And the vintage, the vine cutting the grapes, takes place in October. The grapes are fully ripe by then. And so we roll on into October for the sowing. The olive harvest quite late, November, December, for harvesting the olives, which we shall come to in our talks. And then finally, down in December, pruning of the vines, where you burn up the rubbish, the diseased and badly grown parts of the vines. You burn them up in December and January. And finally, the new season begins in February and March with the blossoming of the almond tree. The very first tree to have its flowers in the spring is the almond tree. And that's a wonderful sight, because the whole land gets filled with this beautiful pink blossom. Same in Ukraine, actually, where we go with our CBM trips. It's a wonderful time in March to see the whole countryside suddenly spring to life with the beautiful blossom on the almond trees. So that's a little review of the land of Israel that they were promised. God had promised it to Abraham, and now it's going to be theirs for the first time. Now, a little time now, if anybody wants to ask any questions, I'll do my best to answer. Not an expert on these things, but please, if you have any questions. My own background was I studied agriculture and then specialised in poultry husbandry, and spent about 13 years as a lecturer in different agricultural colleges about the care of chickens. And then at the end of that time, I moved into the family business and spent the next 27 years as an irrigation specialist, a very different career, but also connected with agriculture and horticulture. Yes, please.
So the early and the late rains, does that only affect Israel
would depart to Jordan as well, yes, it would, yeah, sure.
How far north?
Well, the Hermon, as you go north, you're going to Lebanon as you go further north, and the Hermon's a very high mountain, which, like yours, you can see in the distance here, has snow most of the year round, so it's so high, and it changes then from there northwards, really. Yeah. Yes, please.
It seems unusual that you can grow wheat through the winter, which must be quite cold, because here we sow at the same time, we start October.
Mm-hmm.
And it's harvested in January or January through to March, I suppose. But it's interesting that it actually they grow it through the middle of their winter.
Well, we do in the UK too. Most of our wheat is sown immediately after the harvesting of the previous crop in August. The day the field's cleaned, it's ploughed, and in goes next year's wheat. So it's already green this time of the year now in December. It's green, coming through. And we shall harvest that in August, the wheat, the barley, a couple of months earlier, or a month earlier.
The sower
overtakes the reaper. Well, that's the problem. You have to get rid of the one before you can sow the other, yeah. And actually, that's a bit sad, really, because what's happened now is with this telescoping of the crops for the farmer, greedy to get the very last ounce he can out of his field, it means there's no gap in between the harvesting of the old crop and the sowing of the new one for the birds to come down and pick up the fallen grain. So they lose out, the wildlife. And without the birds, you don't get the other animals. So yeah, it's a bit sad that's happened, really. It's just to keep marching on. You get a few more tons per acre if you do it this way, cutting out the time where the land's not actually doing anything.
Brother David, does Does the working to the seasons affect any of the ecclesias, or did it used to affect any of the rural ecclesias in the UK when you would have meetings?
Oh, I see. Yes, it does indeed. Yes, if you belong to Cambridge meeting, which we did, Catherine and I did for a while, in Cambridge meeting, they're all farmers. Well, no, a lot of them are farmers, arable farmers. It's a wheat land, wheat and potatoes. And yeah, the brothers who are in charge of their farms will come into the break in the bread and they're back home again straight away to catch the crop. Yeah, it is like that. And ploughing time, and same, they'll be very busy. We'll be ploughing at night with search headlights on the cars, on the tractors. Once the conditions are right, you know, you've got to push on. The whole secret of agriculture really is timing.
So what? Some of those verses in Amos, for instance, where they say, you know, when will the Sabbath be over so we can...
Yes, yeah.
Is that what's going on here?
Well, that's right. The Jewish farmers were supposed to stop work on the Sabbath, however good the weather was, and however desperate they were to get the next year's seed in, they had to stop because it was Sabbath. And those who didn't, saying, oh, well, I'm going to get a better crop. But, you know, God says, if you obey me, I'll make sure you don't lose out. You'll have a good crop. And it's a matter of faith, wasn't it, not to go to work on the Saturday if you were a farmer, when all your heathen neighbours were very busy ploughing their fields. Yeah, the test of faith. There's some funny stories about that, you know. I don't know, some of you been to Jerusalem? Yeah? Well, if you go to the Knesset buildings in Jerusalem, there's a... it's very popular, of course, with tourists to go to that. And the Israel Museum's quite close by there. So, you've got wonderful flower beds, you see, all around the Knesset to look nice when the tourists come. Well, the Orthodox Jews came to the government and said, look, we're supposed to rest this land. We're supposed to have a Sabbath every 7 years. You must not plant your flowers in this strip of land because it's the seventh year. So, of course, the government then has to think, oh, that's no good, because that might look very nice for our visitors if we've got weeds growing around the Knesset. So they decided the thing to do was to scrape all the soil off the flower beds and take it over the other side, out of sight, and put it on a big plastic sheet. And they put new compost down around the Knesset and plant all their flowers in it, you see. And at the end of the Sabbath year, they brought the soil back again and put it there. It had its rest. And they carried on. So that kept the Orthodox Jews quiet. Really characteristic way of avoiding the meaning of the law, really. Mm. No, it was a matter of faith. That's a very important point, really. It is for us too, isn't it? I mean, many of us are tempted to go to work on Sundays, or perhaps forced to go to work by our bosses on Sundays when we want to go to the meeting. And sometimes we have to be firm and say, no, I'm not doing that. And if it means we have to change our job, well, we have to trust that God will look after us. If we're seeking first his kingdom, that's the important thing. And he'll make sure we get our daily bread. Not necessarily a Rolls Royce and jam, but bread. Okay, brother.
Yep.
I'll sign off then. And God willing, tomorrow we'll have a look at some of these crops we've been talking about.